Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
The Australian Open has come and gone, but the Tennis Podcast continues. We are into our weekly shows now, building up to the French Open. Wimbledon will be daily again. I'm David Law. Catherine Whittaker is here. How are you, Catherine?
Bright as a button.
Bright as a button, as we record just at the end of the Australian Open campaign. And we're here with our weekly shows. Matt's here. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
Formerly known as Grad Matt, and we are with you for one of our listener questions specials here on the Tennis Podcast, which is kickstarted by you guys, and specifically in this particular edition by Jim Boyle, who is one of our guest editors. So what he's done is he's sent in some of his questions. He's chosen some of the very best of yours that you've posted at Tennis Podcast on Twitter and at The Tennis Podcast on Instagram, and we're on Facebook as well. He's basically picked out the best ones you've sent in, and we're going to answer them now. All right? So Matt's got the questions. Fire away, Matt.
Okay, so the first one is, after two disappointing slams under his charge for Zverev, at what point does Ivan Lendl throw the towel in? And will he see out 2019?
Will he throw the towel in?
Matt's like Dimbleby.
Yeah. Do you think he'll throw the towel in? Or do you think...
I think he probably threw the towel at him in Australia. We sat and watched that fourth round defeat to Milos Raonic together, or certainly most of it together. Yes. We watched the most horrifying parts of it together from his very perspective. And I asked you exactly that. Because I think it's so, I know coaches and players talk a lot about, you know, wafty stuff about it's not about results, it's about the process and process and progress and all of that. But with Zverev, it very specifically is about the results, isn't it? And if the results aren't coming and there isn't even any improvement in the results, I don't know, it's the balance between frustration and pride, isn't there? He'll want to stick with him long enough that his pride isn't damaged by having failed. But equally, he won't just be wanting to throw what's the sort of coaching equivalent of throwing good money after bad, if you know what I mean? Sort of just keep thinking, if I keep staying and keep doing what I'm doing, it's bound to pay off immediately, which is what we're all guilty of thinking with Zverev, isn't it? Just, it's bound to happen eventually. It'll come.
I do feel that Lendl will want to give it enough time so that he can feel as though he's given it a proper chance and that he has been heard and, hopefully from his vantage point, made a difference that makes the difference. That having been said, I remember us talking about this briefly after the US Open, and we were sort of taken aback by his defeat there and still compared how he made an immediate impact on Andy Murray. Remember when we had Goran Ivanišević on the podcast during the Australian Open, and he was questioning the chemistry and talking about how Andy Murray and Lendl were just a perfect fit, and he's not convinced that this one necessarily will be. I would be surprised if they were to split before the end of the year. I certainly think we will see another three slams out of that partnership, because I think that there's a meaningful amount of time again now to debrief after the Australian Open, and then it gets into the other slams. But I'm far from convinced.
Yeah, well, there's no reason to be convinced so far, because it's results-based. I'd love to be a fly on the wall and to see their dynamic. I think it probably all depends on something which is unknown to us, which is how much he's being heard, how much is Zverev listening. You know, it's what, you know, Lendl might be saying all the right things as Zverev's not listening, or it could be other things, I don't know. But if he feels he's being heard and the attitude's right, etc., I suspect he will hang in longer than if he just feels that, you know. Agassi said that about Djokovic, didn't he, at the start of the tournament. I did that interview with him. He said Djokovic was convinced that I could bring him something, and I didn't really think I could, and in the end, we sort of weren't hearing one another, and what's the point in that? So yeah, if you haven't listened already to Goran Ivanisevic's thoughts, Jim, in one of our Australian Open daily pods, I would point you to that, because he was pretty punchy,
yeah,
on that subject, and knows more about coaching player dynamics than we do.
Yes, I do recall that one or two of Andy Murray's losses, including slam final losses, I remember the one here or the Australian Open in 2013, he was very quick to say to Andy Murray, look, it happens, don't worry about it. You know, there was no massive debrief, there's no inquest as such. It was just an acceptance that Djokovic had played well on that day, or whichever final it was. Don't feel like you'll be able to look Zverev in the eye and say it's okay, because it isn't okay what he put up that day. And Zverev, assuming he's getting that kind of pep talk, needs to take that on the chin, and he needs to learn, because it keeps happening, and it's, if he wants to achieve what he believes he's capable of, and what most of us have talked about him being capable of at one time or another, you can't be losing 6-1, 6-1, 7-6 to Milos Raonic in that manner. Much as a good player as he is, two 6-1 sets, it's not enough. It's not acceptable. So I think they'll get through the end of the year, Matt. But we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see thereafter.
Okay, well, you mentioned Milos Raonic, and Jim's next question is about him. After an encouraging run at the Australian Open, is Milos Raonic now one of the favourites for Wimbledon this year, in your opinion?
No. He's in the bunch behind. The absolute favourite for Wimbledon is Novak Djokovic. Roger Federer is, with Rafael Nadal, probably next, I would say. I can't really think of...
You have to put Federer ahead of Nadal, don't you, on their recent records there.
Roger Federer's 5-set loss to Kevin Anderson in the last one, and Rafael Nadal reaching the semi-finals and losing 10-8 in the fifth. So, no, I don't. I don't have to. Based on recent history and the form that Roger Federer's been in recently, no. I don't think I do.
Yeah, but there's what, 5 months until Wimbledon? So we have to look at it in a sort of macro way, don't we?
I don't think he is ahead of Nadal.
We digress from the scintillating subject of Milos Raonic.
And his prospects.
I would put, at this stage, and we are 5 months out?
Yeah.
5 months out. Djokovic is the favourite. Federer is the second favourite. And then Nadal is just behind that. And then there's a crop. And I probably would put him as one of the leaders of that crop, provided he's fit and healthy,
yeah,
which is absolutely no way a given for Milos Raonic. I mean, he's had more injuries than hot dinners, and there are just bodies that hold together and bodies that don't. You know, I know there are certain things that you can, that are within your control to limit all of that, but some people are just gifted in that sense, and unfortunately he's not, is he, Milos Raonic, bless him. But yeah, I'd put him as one of the leading the leaders of the chasing pack.
That's why it was quite... I still find it quite curious that Raonic threw in that performance against Luca Pui, who yep. was very good. But Goran seemed to be saying that he'd got no strength left in his legs. As though maybe he'd run out of gas, really. Maybe a little bit the way Nadal talked about himself not having had a lot of matches. It was a bit of a curious one, that.
Yeah, he needs a foolish season between now and Wimbledon, yeah. I think, to get tour hardened again. I mean, when was the last time Raonic was playing week in, week out, and you know, playing with that consistency?
Broken down a lot, hasn't he?
Yeah, so a whole lot of ifs, but if those ifs come to fruition, what would odds be on him? I know we're bad at odds because we're not betters, but
probably be about 16-1 or something like that. Yeah. You know, he's still...
Well, those are decent odds.
You might even get 20 or something like that.
Yeah.
Because I don't think people are really talking about him at the moment. It's just that we know, having seen a lot of him, and we know he reached the final, and
would he be ahead of Kevin Anderson?
Oh, he might not in sort of bookies odds, maybe not, because Anderson's a more recent Wimbledon finalist.
No,
I think I would put him ahead of him, yeah, as long as he's fully fit. I think he's the better grass court player overall of the two. I think Raonic would be probably about fifth favourite or something like that if he was fully fit.
You're certainly putting him ahead of, like, Zverev.
Yeah, I think I would, on grass I would, yes.
Yeah. I almost said the D word then, but let's move on.
What about Tsitsipas?
Well...
He's going to be interesting to follow on grass, isn't he?
Moving on.
Moving on.
Fun and games.
The next one is, of the two British up-and-coming stars, Katie Bolter and Katie Swan, who do you think has the most potential?
I think up-and-coming players rather than stars... would be how I'd put it, but I know what you mean. I think Katie Swan, but I think David's seen more of both of them than I have. Having said that, Katie Bolter showed me something at the Australian Open that I hadn't seen before from her. I think there is a ceiling. I think her movement isn't that great and can be exposed, but then She's tall, isn't she? So there'll always be I think it can be improved a bit if she puts the work in. But she is showing me something that gives me pause for thought on that. But I like the attitude of Katie Swan a lot.
Yeah.
The most tennis I saw from her was at Wimbledon last year, where she won through that first round match. I can't, off the top of my head, remember who against, but I was very impressed with her, and she's got a real feistiness about her on the court.
Yeah, I don't feel like I've seen enough of Katie Swan as a senior. I watched her as a junior, and she impressed me there. I liked her. She got a great fighting spirit, good mover. She has had injuries since then, and it's, how does that game translate to the senior game? I'd probably go with Bolter based on what she did in the Australian Open. I noticed there's also she qualified in St. Petersburg straight afterwards and beat Bernarda Pera, who's a good player, who's beaten Konta before. You know, I always feel that's important. Can you have a result and then you back it up like that? And she certainly showed more at the Australian Open. I mean, she beat Ekaterina Makarova. That's a good win. She showed a lot more than I would have expected. I was wrong about, certainly in the short term, about her potential. I didn't think she was as good as that. And it was, it was impressive what she did at the Australian Open. She's obviously just got proper power, natural power, that helps you translate into the senior game. So I'd probably go for her, but I don't feel like I know enough about Swan's game yet to have really formed a proper opinion.
It is a worry, isn't it, when players are so injury thwarted so young? My last memory of Katie Swan at the US Open was she was there with her foot in a boot, wasn't she, at the International Tennis Writers event that they hold there, and of course she She wasn't she stretchered off from her qualifying match here at the Australian Open this year.
It wasn't serious.
Her back went into spasm, but it was dramatic, but not serious.
You don't expect.
And
these
think of. I mean, there are plenty of examples, but Tanasi Kokkinakis, for example,
yeah.
The world at his feet, loads of potential, and sort of one injury led to another injury, and he seems to be in a sort of chain reaction of injury, and it can, for reasons I can't quite explain, go that way. So that is a concern, and I hope that that's not the case for her and she can have a good run at it.
Same here.
Okay, Jim's next one, and the final one from Jim is, do you think the Davis Cup finals in Madrid this year will be well attended, or could spectator apathy force a rethink?
I think there will be great atmospheres at times. I think when Spain play, it will be fantastic. It sounds as though Nadal wants to play. I think there will be some nations that bring great followings, who maybe it's quite convenient for. And I guess a lot of depending on how they're promoted and all those sort of things. I think there will be fantastic moments during the Davis Cup, but I wouldn't expect it to be blanket full houses. I would be surprised if that were the case. I hope it is, but I'd be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've said it before on the pod that that's one of the venue is one of my biggest worries for the reinvented Davis Cup, because I've experienced at that venue, and the Madrid Masters, the men's and women's combined event, has so much going for it. It's brilliant. But the venue just somehow isn't quite right. Even when it's at capacity, it kind of feels a bit empty.
Yeah.
It's a very unforgiving arena, which is kind of the absolute opposite of what you want for Davis Cup. I agree with David. I think that they will get good crowds in at times, and I'm very sure that they're aware of this issue. They're not going into this blind about the Madrid, the Calle Magica as a venue, and they'll do everything they can to try and get bums on seats and create atmosphere. You know, they're all good at that, aren't they? The fan academy and all of that. I'm sure they'll do everything they can to plug the potential gaps in atmosphere, but I don't think it's the ideal venue from that perspective, and it does worry me a little, but I hope to be proven wrong. I hope to be proven wrong, but it's not one of the world's more beautiful tennis arenas, the Calle Magica.
It's called the Magic Box. It's like a big metal box, really. You can get
a
good atmosphere.
It's got an airport terminal feel about it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Okay, so Jim's chosen some from social media now. The first one comes from Bello Pegap.
Hello, Bello.
Who says, with Serena Williams winning 17 Grand Slams in the last 10 years, she's followed by Clijsters and Kerber winning 3 in that time. That's the next most.
Amazing
in that time.
Isn't it?
So if Serena, when Serena retires, who do you think's best placed to win multiple slams? For example, the figure plucked here is 10.
Well, Naomi Osaka, without question. She's already on 2. As we said in our podcast after she won the title here, beating Kvitova in the final, something changed that night, and suddenly she's the baseline, she's the benchmark for tennis on the women's side, and slams are hers to lose now. That doesn't mean she'll win them all.
Ahead of Sabalenka.
Yeah. That can change again. Sabalenka, she's 20, isn't she? She can still improve, but so can Osaka. Currently, Naomi Osaka is the benchmark, and slams are hers to lose. I'm trying to think if I've ever seen her play on clay, and I'm not sure. I don't think I ever have in the flesh. So, you know, slight caveat to that. I don't know. I don't quite know how to feel about, you know, whether she'll be the favourite going into the French. But that for me is the sort of the default state of play in the women's game at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. look, I can't argue as much as I'd like to. Osaka has shown again another level at this Australian Open, not only in her mentality, because she showed real mental strength now in two straight slams in all sorts of difficult situations, but her game is so adaptive as well. It not only does she have this power, she understands the game. She understands what to do almost instinctively against different types of players. The range of players she played against at the Australian Open with Shea Sway, and then Anastasia Sevastova, and then Petra Kvitova and Karolina Pliskova. You could not get four more different players, even the two power players. One's a lefty, one's a righty. I mean, it's so difficult to adapt your style or your tactics depending on those particular opponents. And she did it. She found ways, and she's got it all.
And the speed with which she learns. Mm. You know, saying there, you know, I don't know what she's like on clay. Well, if it turns out she's not brilliant on clay now, she probably will be very, very soon.
I think the biggest barrier really to her winning relentlessly is just whether she really wants to be always in the spotlight and always in the kind of that grind of just trying to churn these results out. I don't know what sort of person she's going to be in the long run in that regard. You know, some people just have this absolute insatiable desire to win and to compete at all times. Rafael Nadal being an example of that. Some of these people, they can't, while they're able to, they can't live without doing that, really. They can't imagine an environment where they don't want to do that. Serena Williams, I think, although she's got other interests, etc., and she's got, look, she's still been playing the sport for 20 years and she just loves it. And I think Naomi Osaka absolutely loves playing tennis, and I think she likes winning, but I don't know whether it will matter to her enough to keep having. I mean, you have to really put yourself through the ringer all the time, don't you, to keep coming to these slams, having to go through these pre-event press conferences, talk about your chances, and then just navigate your way through the draw. It is pretty relentless.
Yeah.
It's an unknown, isn't it?
It's an unknown. All I can go on, which is what I've seen of her so far, which is that she somehow manages to make all of that not remotely seem like a grind. She approaches every day with this sort of serendipitous attitude to it all, and yet she seems to have this miraculous combination of steel and grit and desire. I think she does have an insatiable appetite for winning, actually. I think there are fangs, as Mary Carrillo would put it, but equally she currently doesn't see it all as a grind. But as you say, she's only 21.
I just wonder whether she might tire of it, you know. But look, I hope not, because she's such good news for the sport. Fantastic news.
Okay, Keith Horton says, I'd love to hear more about what goes into negotiations for appearance fees at the sort of 250, 500 level. For example, what happens if there's an injury and how does it affect prize money for other players?
Well, I think really what happens depends on the event. They have their own individual strategies and so forth, and some events won't pay any money to any players because, well, maybe they haven't got a budget, so they'll just see who enters their tournament, or they might. You know,
I don't think there are any 250s and 500s that don't pay any appearance fees.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure. I think there are some that probably don't, but lots do. Lots do, no question about it. It's like any negotiation, really. I think it's just business, and depending on what's in the contract, will depend on what they do. I don't think the prize money is relevant to it. It's just a sort of it's just a kind of an offer that they agree on. In order for them to enter a tournament at that level.
I sympathise with Keith asking the question, because I think it's something that ought to be a bit more transparent, really, yeah, or certainly yeah. more talked about. I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with it. What feels uncomfortable about it is the fact that it's opaque and sort of not quite done on the sly, but certainly... certainly, you know, no one's ever asked about it in press or anything, other. It's one of these sort of acknowledged, everyone knows it happens, but nobody acknowledges it. So, I mean, to my knowledge, and my knowledge is far from perfect of it, because it is, you know, it's really only talked about in detail in the inner circles. But is that players pretty much have a fee. This is my fee for playing an event. Yes, you know, there'll be certain events that are swimming in money where you might, you know, market forces, as they say, where you might uplift your fee a little bit. But basically, this is what I cost to play a non-mandatory event. And it's quite funny, you know, when players burst onto the scene, and you know that one year they'll be begging for a wild card into qualies. And the next year, they'll be demanding, you know, some stratospheric figure to even show their face and lose in the first round. So that's always an amusing process to go through. And there, I think there are instances of play. It's not entirely mercenary and cruel-hearted. You know, players that feel a loyalty to a tournament or play tournaments that have given them a wild card in the past and they just want to play there or want to repay some kind of faith that's been shown in them. There are examples of not entirely mercenary behaviour about it, and yet it is all quite a...
It's a business.
One memory I
do have, probably 20 years ago now, I remember one player at a tournament... with a particularly vocal and fairly strong-minded tournament director, and the player lost first round and didn't play well and came off the court and then basically left. And the tournament director told the journalist straight afterwards, "I'm not going to pay him now after that performance." And the player just said, no, he has to pay. And this, yes, this became quite a standoff. So, you know, you don't hear that sort of thing very often, but yeah, I mean, it's difficult to know. I think Catherine's given a good overview of it all, but it does vary from event to event.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Okay, next one from Peter, who says with a lot of passion, when will the let serve finally be abolished? It ruins so many great serves and wastes so much time.
I think Peter should be on the Whittaker family WhatsApp group, because we wasted about a day and a half fervently debating this the other day, as if none of us have anything better to do with our lives.
What were the sides being taken?
Well, it was my brother approaching it in a very sort of statistically philosophical way, just sort of saying, you know, it doesn't. Getting rid of the let cord on serve doesn't. What does that add to tennis at all? Why is everybody? I'm giving an absolutely awful account of his argument. I feel like I should scroll back through the various tennis related spats we've had to find the chain of the group. Basically, I think it is a really weird, anomalous thing in tennis, and if you got rid of it, everyone would go, "Oh yeah, that was silly."
Doesn't it?
And
just,
suddenly, it would seem normal.
Doesn't
we don't have it?
Just bring more luck into the sport, though. You know,
but do we want more luck in the sport?
I don't know. Do we?
Oh God, it's like the family WhatsApp chat all over again, but in real life.
Yeah.
Do we want? Yes. This is where the chat went. You're reminding me now. I'm having horrible flashbacks. Do we want more luck in the sport?
I don't know. Do we?
Matt? Dimbleby?
Well, my experience of the no-let rule in operation was in the juniors at Australian Open. And it's actually quite funny when there's a let serve and it sort of drops rather than properly pings off the tape. And it almost becomes like a drop shot serve. And suddenly the players have to scamper forward and try and get it. And it's so rare that it does happen that on the occasion that it does, it's quite fun. And the only thing would be if it happens on a match point or something, but that's just because we're not used to it.
That's
happening,
the thing,
right?
Isn't it?
I mean, I think we'd quickly adjust.
We will have that period of we had that chap who just didn't even, who just completely forgot that it was in action, and you know, suddenly the match was over and he didn't realise. But yeah, I think you could absolutely get rid of it now. I do.
I might be overestimating Peter's level of interest in this, but I will read you out my brother's message to the family WhatsApp group.
Go on.
To give the other side of the argument, given that we're all in agreement here. He says, unfinished... This was apropos nothing, by the way. The previous thing sent on this chat was a picture of me with a puppy. So, apropos nothing... Up pups, my brother. Unfinished thought on the serve let cord rule. The argument we don't have let cords during rallies, so why on serve, doesn't hold water. If we could somehow eliminate net cords in rallies, we would. But we can't, because it would mean too many replays. But we can on serve, so we do, and solve as much of the problem as we are practically able to. Getting rid of them is unsolving this problem in service of fixing another non-existent problem. Just a little insight into the
inner workings
the Whittaker family WhatsApp group. I said, disagree with the premise that we would eliminate net cords during rallies if we could. And my dad chipped in, I agree with that disagreement. It didn't end there, folks. But
my head hurts.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, oh my God, I'm still scrolling. Wow.
Can we?
but there you go.
Do you want another question?
Can we? Is there a way to, like, join the WhatsApp group without taking part and just watching?
You don't want that. You don't want that, so, trust me.
Rubbernecking.
I think it ended with... It ended with my mum saying, I'm not arguing anything with math anymore. He's become the Whittaker proverbial answering machine in that he has all the answers, probably.
Yeah.
There we go. And actually, that wasn't the end of it. It continued quite a lot from there.
Insight.
It ended with my dad saying, I think the chances of the tennis authorities, that's an inverted commas, either understanding or accepting your argument are pretty small. See, for example, podcast comments on final set tiebreak equality between men and women.
Great.
Lack of appreciation of nuance.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed it. brother, father, if mother, any, Whittaker.
If anyone is still listening, Matt, yeah. Okay. Let's do the next question.
Crack on, we've got time for a couple more.
Okay, Nicholas on Facebook says, why is there a movement to remove Chris Kermode? Is it because some players still want to split into a players' union and a tournaments' union, and the only way to bring about this is radical change?
The main reason that they want rid of Chris Kermode is because of players wanting as much money as they can possibly get and as much say over everything as they can possibly get. And yes, I think ultimately those that are dissenting are in favour of a sort of players' union, or at least a bigger say overall over what goes on generally. They want a bigger slice of the Grand Slam pie, and they talk about how much money the Grand Slams are earning, and their percentage of it is not that high, relatively speaking. The issue for the role of someone like Chris Kermode is that he is running an organisation which is 50% owned by tournaments and 50% owned by players, both of whom inevitably don't have the same goals and disagree and clash, and he is the deciding vote between the two. So it's frankly a pretty impossible job for the most part to keep both sides happy, certainly, and yet you've got to try and find a way to just keep going along together. And personally, I think he's... I mean, I've seen a few CEOs of the ATP, Mark Miles, Etienne de Villiers, the late Brad Drewitt for a short while. I can't remember the other chap's name. Adam something. Anyway, not that memorable. But Chris Kermode has done it for a number of years now, and he, I think, is kind of perfect for it, really. He's been there 5 years. He's brought a new title sponsor into the tour finals after Barclays left. Neato came in. You look at the prize money at the slams, the way it's risen, they're getting £35,000 losing in the first round now. You know, your winners are getting £2 million plus. I know maybe it's not the biggest slice of the overall pie, I don't know, but how much do you want? Keep it moving forward. Do you really need any more instability? You're getting your ATP Cup. I mean, I don't see what the problem is.
I think all of the movements against Chris Kermode are fundamentally misguided. I think what they are is movements against the structure of the ATP. As a governing body, which does have a conflict of interest at its heart. But I think it's a complete misdirection to think that that's anything to do with Chris Kermode as an individual, because he's just walking the tightrope that is the defining feature of that job because of the way the organisation is structured. So
good luck finding somebody else who would do it better.
Yeah. Exactly.
Unless you want to rip the thing up and start again, you're going
to
struggle.
Which, you know, there's a decent argument for that.
There is an argument for it.
It is a bizarrely structured organisation, as are many governing bodies in tennis, but to talk about it as something sort of specific or personal about the way Chris Kermode goes about that job, I find
also
bizarre, because if he were more player-centric, all the tournaments would be talking about, hey, let's get rid of Chris Kermode and have a tournaments union instead.
He's always been regarded as somebody who the players get on with. Over years at Queens, when he was tournament director, that was one of the big things that, you know, was in his favour. All the players loved him. Because he talked to them, and he knew how to talk to them, and he knew how to deal with them, etc. In terms of starting again, it's a nice idea, but again, who's really going to sort all that out at a time when surely stability would be better?
Yeah, we can't even get rid of the let cord on serve, no. So I doubt anyone's tearing up the whole administrative structure of tennis.
Right, one more question then, Matt, what we got?
Make it a good one.
From Grant, he says, is this the best time you can remember to have an interest in the women's game? He says it's so hotly contested, there's nothing to choose between a lot of players. And can you remember a time when you've seen it as close as this between so many players?
My answer would be absolutely not the best time. I think it is one of many very good times. I am really enjoying what's going on at the moment, the emergence of Naomi Osaka, the fact that Serena Williams is still there, the fact that Venus Williams is still there, the fact that you've got Arina Sabalenka, Caroline Wozniacki and Simona Halep breaking their ducks and becoming world number one. There's loads of good storylines out there. But goodness me, over the years, you think back to when Clijsters and Enan were there, and Jennifer Capriati and Steffi Graf before that, and then go back further, Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert. There's been so many good years and decades and generations. So much as I'm delighted you're enjoying it, Grant, and I get why you, the variety of winners at the moment is, some people might not like it, some people love it. I find it very exciting. I think there's loads of good players to watch, lots to get your teeth into, but do I think it's the best year ever? No, I don't.
I think that's all really well said. I mean, my memory doesn't go back as far as yours, and I it's a great...
That's a dig, isn't it?
No, I was just... It's a great regret that... I wish I'd experienced Evert Navratilova. I really wish that. Mm. But, I mean... Yes, no point dwelling on that. And yeah, I think Enan Clijsters, you know, yeah, all the ones you mentioned, brilliant. Martina Hingis won Wimbledon when she was 15. Yeah. 15.
And played the game differently too, you know. It's great.
Monica
Seles.
I mean, yeah, you don't need us to, or maybe you do, but look, exactly as David said, I'm just going to repeat it, but tennis, women's tennis, is in a brilliant spot at the moment. I really think that the Serena story continues to be exceptional, and if and when she gets to 24 or more, and becomes, you know, well, she won't be the first woman to win a Grand Slam after coming back from pregnancy. But for me, it's not just about her coming back from pregnancy; it's about her coming back from nearly dying and all the rest of it. So if and when she does that, it will be one of the greatest sporting stories of all time. You've got Osaka that we just can't get enough of waxing lyrical about. It's all absolutely brilliant, but it has been brilliant at many points in the past. The last 20 years we have had, I mean, Serena and Venus Williams they are one of the greatest sporting stories ever. Their success.
Yeah.
You know, their father, the whole genesis of all of it, every aspect of it, is one of the greatest sporting stories ever. And, women's tennis has been doing just fine for a long time. But, hey, if more people are paying attention to how great it is, that is brilliant.
I say put aside, Grant, a weekend and just go on
YouTube.
Go on YouTube and
Stefanos Tsitsipas taught us all how to use YouTube.
Yeah.
At the Australian Open.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So go and use that. Go and have a great big helping. So
that is it. Thanks to Jim.
Yeah.
Tennis.
We have, yeah, in this 45-minute show. We're gonna have other listener question specials here on the Tennis Podcast with guest editors who have backed us to the hilt on Kickstarter and helped keep this show going, because, you know, without the Kickstarter, we wouldn't have the budget to be able to get Matt to work with us and to be able to put as much time into this as we do. And we hope you're enjoying it. You seem to be. We're thrilled that you do, and we love bringing these to you as well. So we have been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com, with a mascot which is Rio with a Y, a lovely dog. Go and check out his Instagram page, and we will be back with more Tennis Podcasts in the weeks to come. Thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.